Today on Mr. Media, I'll talk to Saul Austerlitz, author of Sitcom, a history in 24 episodes from I Love Lucy to Community. Stick around. We'll all be singing theme songs from All in the Family, MASH, It's About Time, and Gilligan's Island before you know it.
I don't think anyone wants to hear me sing any of those songs.
They don't want to hear me either. So much media, so little time. Who keeps track of it all? That would be me. This is Bob Andelman, and this is a Mr. Media interview, brought to you by Amazon.com, Audible.com, and 1-800-DIAL-DJs. Please stop by the website, MrMedia.com, click on our advertisers, support the show. And remember, there's more than 1,000 interviews available at MrMedia.com. We've been doing this since February 2007. Hope you'll find something you like. And thanks for listening. Mr. Media is recorded live before a studio audience of George Jetson, Jane, his wife, my mother, the car, Eddie's father, and Mr. Ed, who just stuck his head through the barn door, in the new media capital of the world, St. Petersburg, Florida. What makes a TV comedy funny? Now, I'm not talking about dissecting punchlines or setups, but more the idea of the makeup of the medium's meat and potatoes, the sitcom. Why, for example, did the Dick Van Dyke Show soar, but the new Dick Van Dyke Show didn't, while the Mary Tyler Moore Show did? Why was All in the Family socially acceptable on CBS in 1971, but Dad's on Fox is offensive today? Saul Austerlitz, I promise, will explain it all. No pressure, Saul. He's the author of a new book called Sitcom, a history in 24 episodes from I Love Lucy to Community. Now, this is Saul's second visit to our show, and first via video. He was previously my guest to discuss his last book, Another Fine Mess, A History of the American Film Comedy. And with that, Saul, welcome back to Mr. Media.
Thanks so much for having me.
Good to actually see you this time. I'm going to guess that the hardest thing about writing sitcom was narrowing down the field from 70 years of TV to just 24 episodic examples.
That was definitely a challenge, and I started off with a broader list of shows that ended up getting whittled down a bit. But in part, the choices were somewhat self-selecting. It was fairly obvious with older shows which ones were worth writing about and worth emphasizing as being kind of pinnacles and exemplars of the medium. You know, so writing about something like the Dick Van Dyke Show or the Mary Tyler Moore Show or All in the Family, you know, it didn't require any major advanced work to know that I was going to be writing about those. With more recent shows, I think it was a little bit more challenging, probably more room for discussion. I'm sure some people will, you know, wish that certain shows had been included that I didn't choose, or feel like shows I did choose were ridiculous or, you know, misplaced. But I feel like I ended up with a pretty representative list, and a list that includes what I consider to be most of the major highlights of the sitcom. But obviously there's endless room for argument about that.
Well, and of course I want to ask you about that, because I think the book is fascinating reading, but I think part of the fun of the book is to get into a discussion about what should be on the list, what shouldn't be on the list, what got left out. It's kind of like, I mean, Entertainment Weekly's letters column every week is every time they do a list of something, they give people time the next week to comment on, you know, why their favorite was left out or, you know, whatever. So tell me, you mentioned that you started with a bigger list. What were some of the shows that you left out of your own list before I question you about some of mine?
Well, some shows that I had initially thought that I was going to write about and just ended up not exactly working out, or I felt like they were more easily covered under the mantle of one of the already existing chapters, were shows like South Park, which I think is fascinating and a really superb show that has been successful for a very long time. But ultimately, I decided that it was so much in the vein of what The Simpsons had already done, that it was really mostly worth discussing, you know, in the context of my book as being a kind of inheritor of The Simpsons tradition.
Saul, excuse me. I've got – is that right? Trey and Matt want to talk to you after the show. Meet them in the alley behind your house.
Will do.
Sorry. No, go ahead, please.
Obviously, you know, not picking anything or leaving anything out is always going to be a bit controversial. I also thought about writing about the 1970s show Soap, which I think is kind of a fascinating oddity. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, I felt like I just didn't have enough to say about it to propel an entire chapter's worth, but it does strike me as being a particularly interesting attempt to reinvent the sitcom a little bit before the era that we think of as doing the reinvention. But, you know, it didn't quite make the cut in the end. But I wish that I could have figured out a way to get it in there also. But probably good that the book doesn't run 900 pages.
What about The Simpsons? Not The Simpsons, The Flintstones.
The Flintstones. Also, an interesting show. I ended up feeling like all the animated series really belong together. Mm-hmm. So I mentioned The Flintstones as being a precursor to The Simpsons. It didn't strike me that there was necessarily enough meat there to justify writing 4,000 words about. But, you know, in as much as The Flintstones is a kind of animated ripoff of The Honeymooners and also is, you know, a primetime animated series that anticipates shows like The Simpsons and South Park and Family Guy, it is definitely an interesting series to mention.
And did you feel that a show had to have been on the air a certain length of time to make the list?
No, I ended up deciding to include Freaks and Geeks, which I think some people will be pleased about, and some people will feel like this isn't really appropriate here. It's not a sitcom, you know, it runs an hour long, etc. My feeling was any show that struck me as being something that pushed the sitcom forward or that extended what the possibilities were for a comedy series on television was suitable to write about. And even though Freaks and Geeks was watched basically by nobody when it was on the air and only lasted for a season, it struck me as being a really, really interesting example of how what we once thought of as a sitcom, you know, this half-hour show with a laugh track that's about a family, etc., could really have its horizons expanded such that something like Freaks and Geeks, which really confuses the difference between comedy and drama and leaves us often unclear whether we should be crying or laughing or doing both at the same time, to me really fits the bill because it provides a template for what the sitcom ends up doing in the decade that follows. Mm.
Now, there was a period of time, and I don't know if I have my dates right here or not, maybe it was around the time of Freaks and Geeks, maybe it was a little before, a little after, where we were talking about the dramedy a lot. John Ritter had a show, I think, that was sort of right on the line between comedy and drama. And there were two other shows I thought of that were very short-lived, but I thought they were very influential. I thought, this is why I'm throwing this out, Dabney Coleman's Buffalo Bill, and actually Dennis Leary's The Job, which led to Rescue Me. And he just took recycled pretty much all the same people and just put them in a different setting. But the show itself was very funny and quite outrageous. It just didn't last.
Yeah, I think those are all really good examples of what starts to happen in the 1980s. And even shows that we think of as dramas from that era, like St. Elsewhere, have a lot of really comedic elements. The way that they handled it was more having specifically comedic characters who would be delegated the kind of funny subplot.
Howie Mandel.
Like Howie Mandel, exactly. And I think that holds true for later series as well, less the, you know, having the individual character, but more the combination of comedy and drama. You can really see it in a series like The Sopranos or The Wire, which are obviously very serious shows in a lot of ways and have been taken very seriously, but have an inordinate amount of comedic elements and are often quite funny. Mm-hmm. I think also in terms of what you're describing of the dramedy, a series like Sex and the City, which often kind of gets pigeonholed in a certain way, is really a prime example of a show that mingles comedy and drama really effectively, that can be really funny and really moving, and uses the same characters and the same themes and the same storylines to do both at the same time.
Now, you mentioned Freaks and Geeks, and that was one of two that I looked at on the list, and I went, well, okay, I can understand. I mean, Freaks and Geeks, if for no other reason than the cast and the people behind the camera had an incredible impact on comedy for years to come. But the other one I thought of was Taxi, kind of on the borderline for me, because it was never a huge hit. It's not – there's a certain core of people who really liked it and really go back to it, but it seemed like – I don't know. For me, those two were kind of on the line, knowing how many comedies were out there that were groundbreaking and made it a long time. Not that I'm suggesting you should have included Becker or anything like that. Don't get me wrong. But those were the two that kind of struck me. And then I should pause. Did you want to say anything about a Taxi, for example?
I guess what I don't dispute anything you're saying about Taxi. It obviously was not anywhere near the success that some of the other 1970s shows that I wrote about were. It's not as big a success as Cheers or The Cosby Show, which are the shows I write about afterwards, were. And yet, I think something about it was really indicative of what started to happen with sitcoms at that time. In the chapter, I write a lot about the supporting cast of Taxi. You know, I think some people, even people who like Taxi, may forget that, you know, the ostensible leading character is Judd Hirsch, who's kind of this straight man figure, but the show really ends up being hijacked in a good way by Andy Kaufman and Danny DeVito and Christopher Lloyd, and I think is representative of the way in which these kind of nutty sidekicks who have been a presence in the sitcom from the days of Ed Norton on The Honeymooners really become the main feature. Mm-hmm. You know, so they rather than have this sort of endless dynamic of the normal guy and the crazy, wacky friends, I think shows end up becoming much more about the wackiness and the more interesting, offbeat characters, and less about the sort of standard issue boilerplate leading men and leading women. So I thought that was particularly interesting in terms of Taxi.
You know, I just thought of two sidekicks. It just popped into my head. I was thinking of on Good Times, the woman who lived downstairs, who was always in the I can't think of the family's name, always in the house. I mean, J.J. Jimmy Walker was obviously became the star of the show, but there was a woman who downstairs who was always the jive talking woman who came upstairs and did that thing. And then another All in the Family, that was an All in the Family spinoff, and then another All in the Family spinoff, of course, was the Jeffersons. And the sidekick there, I believe, was the British neighbor who was basically didn't fit in, but always just kind of became part of things.
Right. Saying outrageous things.
Yeah.
Good. Actually, I think is a double spinoff of All in the Family.
It right.
Spinoff. So they, you know, Norman Lear was really working his magic back in the 70s.
It's amazing to me that I don't think I spend much time with Good Times anymore, but I will still sit down and watch an episode of The Jeffersons, and I still think those shows are very well constructed. They're very funny. They stuck to the essence of what they were.
Yeah, for me, I have to say that they didn't really work for me anymore, and I felt the same way about All in the Family. Although it's obviously a more groundbreaking and more interesting show, they both sort of felt to me like one joke series. They just said the same thing happens over and over and over, and obviously that's true of sitcoms in general. But when it's meant to be outrageous, you know, at some point Archie Bunker stops being so outrageous because he's done it already. And I felt kind of the same about George Jefferson. He was sort of a one trick pony, and it amazes me that the Jeffersons was on the air for, I don't know, 11 or 12 seasons, whatever it was. It's hard to believe that they had enough material to keep it going for that long.
The only fault I have with the Jeffersons is when they swapped out the Lionels and didn't even make a self-referential and then they swap back. You know, it's kind of like you referenced that in Roseanne, of course, where they did that with the Beckys.
Roseanne made a few jokes about it.
They made many, and they did it in the opening credits even. They yeah. they show the two girls and evolving back and forth, and it's just crazy. There's only two premium cable TV shows or sitcoms on the list: the Larry Sanders Show, Gary Shandling, and you mentioned already Sex and the City, Sarah Jessica Parker. But there's no cable sitcoms, no, if you will, free cable sitcoms that are not like HBO.
I also had Curb Your Enthusiasm, so there was another one.
Three. I'm sorry. You got me there. Yeah, Curb. I would have argued, I think, for It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I really like that show. I think it's an excellent series. It struck me as being very much under the sign of Curb Your Enthusiasm. That Curb Your Enthusiasm is about this outrageous character wandering through what we recognize as kind of ordinary, you know, middle class, upper middle class life in Los Angeles and wreaking havoc everywhere he goes. And I felt like It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia was similar in some ways in terms of its approach. Emily Nussbaum of The New Yorker described that show and a few others as being part of a trend that she called dirtbag sitcoms, which I thought was a very apt phrase. You know, there's something about those guys and Larry David and Louie, all of which seem to fit together in some ways. They're really, you know, truth tellers in some ways, uncomfortable truth tellers. And part of what is so remarkable about their shows is their ability to find new sacred cows to undermine. It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, I think, is very good. It doesn't strike me as being quite as good as either of those other shows, but I wish I'd had a bit more room to talk about it in more detail.
Louis was one I was going to bring up later as well. Yeah, because that's a phenomenally oddball thing in the way that it works, and it doesn't apologize for anything. it's not like it's All in the Family aged. Archie evolved in some ways. I wouldn't say that the show apologized for anything, but Louis, there's no apology for anything. Louis is who Louis is. Louis C.K., for people who don't know what we're talking about. I just think it's a brilliant show. I don't get tired of rewatching that one at all.
Oh, yeah. I mean, to me, it's the most experimental sitcom that I can think of on TV right now, or maybe ever. Maybe Curb Your Enthusiasm and Seinfeld rival it, but the things that he manages to do on the show to veer from having, you know, a couple of episodes that are about Louis potentially taking over a late night talk show and have other episodes be about crazy relationships with women and, you know, have one where he's on a date and a woman gets on a helicopter and flies away at the end. I mean, there's such a variety from this really intense realism, you know, this realism of my show is going to be about how crappy it is to be a father and how crappy it is to be single in New York and, you know, just sort of general unpleasantness of life, which he manages to make very, very funny. And then also be totally off the wall, unbelievable, you know, David Lynch is my secret late night comedy mentor. And it just all hangs together. And obviously sometimes it doesn't work at all. There are occasions where, you know, one sketch or another will just fall flat, but most of the time it's an incredible high wire act.
How important, we made a little reference earlier to the sidekick, but how important is the star of the show to helping the audience in a sitcom get over an episode that's maybe not so good and come back next week because you feel he or she is so charismatic or is a great actor that you want to keep giving them the chance to entertain you?
Yeah, I mean, I think sitcoms begin from the outset as being a kind of surrogate home that we can visit every week and see these friends of ours. You know, in actuality, we obviously understand we never knew Jackie Gleason or Lucille Ball or Dick Van Dyke, but there was something so comforting about being in their presence that we were really happy to keep tuning in and seeing what they were up to. And the sitcom has evolved in a lot of ways from that. It's not as carefully constrained within the boundaries it first established for itself. You know, it doesn't necessarily have to always be about one likable main character. It doesn't have to necessarily be about a family. It doesn't have to necessarily take place at home. But that same sense of wanting to see what this main character, this figure that we enjoy being in the company of, is up to week after week, I think is still true in a lot of ways today. And obviously, a lot of shows have created much more repellent main characters than we used to be comfortable with or familiar with. You know, Larry David is not Dick Van Dyke.
Right.
But there is something similar, which is that television is such a warm medium. You know, it's one in which we feel like we have a personal relationship with the people we see in a way that I think most people don't feel like they have a personal relationship with Brad Pitt when they see him in a movie, or, you know, U2 when they go to the concert. There's something about TV that still feels very homey in a lot of ways. And I think that is really what motivates, to a large extent, this willingness to watch the same people kind of do the same things over and over, week after week, year after year, without really getting tired of it ever.
Well, I want to talk to you a little bit about Ted Danson. He's kind of a floating thread in the book for a lot of reasons, because of Cheers, which was on the air for, I don't know, 18,000 seasons, whatever it was. And then there's a reference in the Seinfeld chapter to Ted Danson. Jason Alexander's character George makes reference to him late in the chapter. He's talking about he wants to make Ted Danson money, or
right. Even in the series finale, their plane is about to crash, and he's worried about Ted Danson. Would they be on the plane with Ted Danson, or would Ted Danson be on this kind of plane? You know, it's this obsession that he seems to have.
And then Ted Danson shows up to play himself in and out of the entire Curb Your Enthusiasm series. I am assuming that Larry David and Ted Danson go back a long way for him to be tweaking him in Seinfeld. And then, you know, he comes on and plays himself, and sometimes he's a bit of a doofus on Curb. But also, I was thinking, I mentioned Becker earlier, which starred Ted Danson as complete opposite of Sam Malone from Cheers. Sam Malone on Cheers, the lovable guy, former ball player, you know, everybody wants to know him, the women all want to sleep with him. Becker, what an asshole. I mean, he comes back and he deliberately plays this asshole. And you were talking about guys like Louis and Larry David, who are not exactly, you know, pleasant people to be around. Where does Ted Danson fit into all this stuff? How does he manage to be? And now, of course, he's on CSI. He's playing this crime scene investigator. I mean, who would have guessed that would have happened? Well, you know, Ted Danson, the most important man in television history. What happened here?
In some ways, maybe. I think you could make an argument. I mean, I think that Sam Malone isn't quite as lovable as you make him out to be. He's definitely a character that people love, but he's pretty repellent also. You know, he's always discussing his sexual conquests, and he's kind of self-obsessed and self-absorbed, and in a really lovable way, but, you know, he's a somewhat more complicated character, maybe.
Okay, I'll go with that.
I think that Larry David in particular is probably obsessing about Ted Danson. I mean, I'm sure they're pals, but, you know, Cheers was also one of the last really huge hits on NBC before Seinfeld came along, so in some ways, they were looking to slay that dragon. Mm. And amazingly, Seinfeld became, you know, a hit at the same level as Cheers did. But, you know, there's something, like we were just talking about, I think there's something about those people that we watch on screen over and over that compels us to remain interested in them, to see what they're up to try out these new shows even when they failed. You know, I mean, Bill Cosby's going to be back on TV soon. He's going to have a new series. You know, I can't imagine it's going to be very good, but I'd love it if it was. You know, I spent my childhood hanging out with Bill Cosby when he was Dr. Cliff Huxtable. Mm-hmm. You know, there's something about that, I think, that's hard to erase even after you've maybe suffered through some of the dreck that comes after, you know, a big hit.
I saw that Bob Newhart, as recently as a few months ago, was talking about doing another show. It's like, Bob, you're like 100. You know, I mean, but yeah, I mean, he's still funny, but wow. Talk, if you would, a little about what you try to – you mentioned that these chapters are about 4,000 words. So I wonder if you could explain to people watching or listening to the show what you kind of sought to accomplish in each chapter about a show. And I'll point out while you think about that for a second, I'll point out that while there are 24 shows that are featured in chapters, you do weave in other shows within each of those chapters. You do talk about – you know, and in The Honeymooners, you'll talk about other shows, and Leave It to Beaver, you're talking about Father Knows Best or whatever. So it's not that it's exclusively about that show and a particular episode from that show. So right. Maybe explain a little bit about what people find in the chapters.
Yeah, I mean, I was trying to think of a good way to organize this book because it's obviously such a giant topic and it's unwieldy in some ways. You know, how do you talk about 65 years of television without just overwhelming readers with, you know, this is a list of every show ever on TV. So my feeling was, you know, sitcoms are really reflected in their episodes, especially the sort of classic sitcom that we think about. You know, each episode bore a tremendous amount of resemblance to every other episode. You know, Lucy wanted to get famous and got herself into trouble and then had to resist.
Yeah. Sorry, just couldn't resist.
So, you know, I felt like picking individual episodes and, you know, particularly interesting or compelling or representative episodes as a way of getting into the story would be a way to allow people to really feel the structure of the sitcom, to feel the way that each episode was constructed, and use that as a way to tell this larger story of what series were about as a whole, and then also what was happening in television. So, for example, I write about Gilligan's Island, which I think is a pretty terrible TV show all told, but is really representative of what's happening in TV in that era, mm-hmm. in, you know, the sort of fallow period of TV in the mid to late 60s. So it presented itself to me as being a really good way to get into telling the story of, you know, what the hell was happening on TV between the Dick Van Dyke Show going off the air and, you know, All in the Family and MASH and the Mary Tyler Moore Show coming on a few years later.
You mentioned in the acknowledgments, you apologize, I think, to your son, who must be a newborn, for forcing him to sit through all 98 episodes of Gilligan's Island. In researching this show, did you really watch all 98 episodes of Gilligan's Island?
I did, actually. I'm not proud of it, but I did. In retrospect, I probably could have lived without doing that, but I tried to really be completist about this. And so the shows that I wrote about, I pretty much watched every episode. Although, you know, some of the series I cheated a bit. I can't say I watched all 25 seasons, no joke, 25 of The Simpsons. And some of the later episodes of All in the Family might have gotten, you know, ditched along the way. But generally, I really tried to watch all of it so that I could, you know, do the best job I could of saying what happened in the entire series. But yeah, I mean, there was some collateral damage along the way. My newborn son had to sit through too much Gilligan's Island. Luckily, he didn't know what was going on, so it was okay.
You didn't feel the need to go back and watch Archie Bunker's place in its entirety to know that you did not want it in the book?
I felt safe to assume that it probably was not going to find a home. Mm.
Hey, you know what? I hadn't thought about this before, but I'm going to ask. One of my favorite sitcoms in recent years was very short-lived. I'm just curious to get your thought on it, if you've even watched it. It was called Worst Week with Kyle Bornheimer.
I actually never watched
it. Oh!
What do you like about that?
Oh, my God. It was so clever. It was – I never really – entirely understood the concept of Worst Week. It was adapted from a British show, and I watched that a few times. I didn't find that funny, but this show, I guess it was mostly Bornheimer. He's just so physically, and he's physically funny, and his delivery is funny, and the situations. You take the sitcom, you got to watch a couple episodes of this show because it is to me, it was always the classic sitcom combining the smart sitcom with the inanity of Gilligan's Island. And
I'll have to check that out.
Yeah, I mean, you know, if you see some of the stills from the show, for example, there's one of him his fiance, or no, I think he and his fiance are at a friend's house who has young children and who is nursing. And at one point, just for fun, he puts on the pumps, and his fiance catches him, and then of course the woman whose pumps they are sees him, you know, topless with the pumps on. I don't know, it's hard to explain. At one point they set a pool on fire in one episode. In the last episode, he's now married to this woman, and she's pregnant, his wife is pregnant, and they're trying to get to the hospital. And he is like, everything that could possibly get in the way of him getting to the hospital happens. He gets injected with some kind of a sedative. He gets into a car wreck. I don't know. It lasted, I think, 22 episodes. The minute that went on sale at Amazon, it's one of the few series that I have gone out and bought. And I generally find that people who've watched any of it feel like I do. But a lot of people just never watch it. It's just one of those sitcoms that couldn't. I don't think you could explain it in a high, what's the phrase that they use, a high concept sentence.
Right.
Look how long it took me to explain.
I feel like I need to go out and watch it right now.
I think you'd like that. I read yesterday in one of the Hollywood trades that the sitcoms are the new black for the fall season. That sitcoms are coming back in a huge way. Is that necessarily a good thing?
Well, I think that the networks keep trying to recreate the mojo that they had. You know, NBC is still trying desperately to figure out a way to get that huge audience that it had, you know, Thursday nights, Tuesday nights. And it hasn't really been able to, I think in part because the good shows it has are just a little bit too smart for its audience in some ways. You know, I write about Community in my book, which I think is an amazing series.
Agreed.
Is just not ever going to be Seinfeld or Friends. And it knows it, and it's self-aware about it, and in some ways some of the humor of the show is about that.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I think that it's funny to me that given how much more interest there is in television these days and how much more seriously it's taken, and how many good shows there are on TV right now, you know, like all the ones that we've just been talking about, that really big audience, you know, that really kind of unifying audience where everyone watches a certain sitcom and then is talking about it, you know, from the glory days of The Cosby Show and Cheers and Seinfeld, doesn't really exist anymore. Mm-hmm. You know, the most popular sitcom on TV these days is The Big Bang Theory, which, you know, some people like and some people don't, but definitely is not a show that anyone feels compelled to watch, you know, at risk of being left out of the cultural conversation. So, I find that to be a surprising fact in general, and I wouldn't be surprised if the networks are trying to recreate that magic in the hopes of, you know, getting to that one or two new shows that are able to you know, become part of that conversation, you know, to sort of become the comedy version of The Sopranos or Breaking Bad or, you know, any of those shows that people feel like they absolutely must see.
I think and by the way, I should point out that for the most part, 22 out of 24, I completely agreed with your choices in the book. I don't think I said that up front. I should point that out. I would say on The Big Bang Theory, I don't know that I agree with what you just said. I think it's been a remarkably smart show from day one. And the interesting thing is now that they're in their fifth or maybe sixth season, and we know it's been renewed for like two more years at least, they've done something that a lot of shows have not succeeded at over the years. They have added to their core the core conceit of the show, these three nerds and the pretty girl, and each character has basically gained a sidekick or an additional character, and they found, I think, very inventive ways and logical ways to broaden the show and still keep it clever, still keep it on target for what it's been about. But, you know, they've gone from four characters to eight characters, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I have to admit to a general bias, which is just that I find CBS sitcoms, which some of which are fairly decent, to just be unwatchable for me. mostly because of the laugh track issue. It's just, it's hard for me to watch shows with laugh tracks in 2014. It feels just odd and like I'm in some sort of time warp. So I think The Big Bang Theory and How I Met Your Mother are not bad. Perfectly fine shows. Mm-hmm. I don't have anything majorly negative to say about them. They just feel so culturally out of place in some ways that they're trying to recreate this, 1980s model of sitcom 30 years later, that they feel weird to me. It feels like CBS is not engaging in the same conversation that everyone else is. And in some ways, it's a very successful position for them to stake out. They have most, if not all, of the most popular scripted series on network TV. I just find that their shows range from being pretty unwatchable to fine, but not particularly interesting. So How I Met Your Mother, Big Bang Theory, they're good shows. They're well done. They're not, they don't exist in the same sentence as Two Broke Girls or Two and a Half Men, which I think are pretty bad. But I personally don't have anything all that interesting to say about them. They seem to me to be another version of what we've already seen.
All right. Well, I will agree to disagree with you on those. Both those shows, I think How I Met Your Mother I think it's quite clever, actually, but we won't go down there. I will say I'm very glad that you didn't try to convince me or other readers that Parks and Recreation was a piece of genius sitcom. I think it's one of the worst things on TV. I think it's just the stupidest sitcom. Yeah, I've tried watching it several times. I think it deserves its low ratings. I think the only reason it's still on the air is what you were talking about, is that NBC is trying so desperately to find something to bring people back to that channel with, and they have nothing better to replace it with. I think it's horrible. It's just a horrible, horrible sitcom. It's just not funny, not clever. And I think it's a total waste of Amy Poehler, because I think she's adorable, and I think she's very funny. And I think in 5 years, when it's gone, nobody's going to be harking back to it like they did Seinfeld or any other show in this book, including Freaks and Geeks, for that matter.
Yeah, I think it's a show that people want to like a bit more than it maybe deserves. But at the same time, we can acknowledge that the same lack of anything better to put on that keeps Parks and Rec on the air, for better and for worse. I mean, I think it's fine, but I'm also not a major devotee of it. Also keeps Community on the air, which I'm very pleased
about. I'm in favor of that. Anything that keeps Community on the air, I agree.
NBC hitting rock bottom for people who like some of what they actually have on the air right now.
Now, I can't remember. I'm going to cheat and look. There was just two shows that just struck me. I know I could ask. Okay, it is there. Okay, so The Office is in the book. Modern Family is not in the book. Mm-hmm. Tell me.
I wrote about Modern Family, but I didn't devote a whole chapter mm-hmm. to it. Again, Modern Family is a good show. It's well done. It has its moments. It just felt to me to be very predictable. It's not exactly in the same boat as the CBS shows that I talked about. It doesn't have a laugh track. It's a little bit more of a kooky ensemble like The Office is. But, it's... I know where it's going to go before it goes there. I thought it was an interesting show. It's a show that's worth mentioning, but it didn't strike me as being something that there would be enough to say to devote an entire chapter to, nor did it feel to me like it was worthy of being talked about at such length.
Completely disagree with you. Completely and totally disagree with you. But that's okay. As you were saying that, I was thinking you and I could probably program two very different and very interesting sitcom 24-hour channels, because tastes would be very interesting.
I'm sure you've heard the statement that everyone is an expert in two things: their own area of expertise and television. So, my feeling is this is literally something where there is no one who's not an expert.
True.
And has expert opinion on. my only claim to having any authority is just that I've sat in my chair and watched all this television at once. But even that doesn't necessarily separate me from the field of regular television watchers. So I'm very, very happy to have the arguments. I'm sure this is going to be the first of 100, 1,000, 1,000,000 arguments. And I think that's great. I mean, people are really passionate about TV. People love TV. It's something that's really personal to them in some ways. And I think that's great.
All right, one more show that I found very interesting, and then I won't bring up any more shows and we'll start to wrap it up. I wonder if you spent any time watching episodes on Showtime.
Yes, I really liked episodes. I talk about it at some length in the book, although, you know, maybe not quite as much space as I would have liked to. A really interesting show that kind of fits in with the self-referential vibe of a lot of more recent experimentally minded TV. So, you know, I thought of, obviously, Episodes has the Friends connection. You know, Matt LeBlanc is playing himself, and he's also very self-consciously playing not Joey. You know, his character is not Joey. He's constantly dealing with people who think he's going to be Joey, and he's very much not that. It also strikes me as being very much in the vein of Curb Your Enthusiasm, which is also about, you know, what happens after you finish your defining thing in life, right? You finish the thing that you know when you die is going to be the first thing mentioned in your obituary. So what do you do after that? I think Curb Your Enthusiasm is really interesting in using that as a sort of permanent subplot of the show. And Episodes is clearly about that also, at the same time that it's this sort of farce about TV and about the kind of vapidity of Los Angeles. But it's a wonderful show. I haven't gotten to catch up with all of it yet, but I've really enjoyed what I've seen of it.
Well, there's one moment, if you haven't seen this, I apologize. I'm not giving away a plot twist. It's just a moment in the show. You talk about how Matt LeBlanc is constantly trying to play not Joey. He winds up in bed with his current co-star's daughter, who he thinks is his sister. He thinks is the woman's sister. She's 19. He winds up in – he's still very people who haven't seen the show, he's still very sought after by women. And he winds up in bed with this 19-year-old, and they're – in the process of having sex, and she's getting there. She says, "Come on, say it. You gotta say it." "Say what?" "You know, you gotta say it, Joey." "What?" "You gotta say it." He goes, "Do I have to?" "Yes, you must say it." You know, she's getting louder and more shrill. "Okay. How you doing?" You know? She goes, "Yes." And I'm just like, oh my God. I mean, you know, yeah, he's having to live down, and he's talked about how terrible the Joey spinoff was. And he's explaining how, because I think Pux is in danger on this network. That's his show on the show. And he's talking about, well, how do you know when you're canceled? What do they do? Why do they make you film these episodes that they're never going to show? He says, oh, they show them. He said, we had 8 episodes that they burned off in the summer. They show them eventually somewhere to somebody. He said, this is only 3 episodes. Think about having to tape 8 more episodes knowing that no one, you know, it's going like to be played at summer at like 11 o'clock at night or something. So it's a very fun show.
Well, he's also on the show, he's this sort of savant of sitcoms. You know, he has this conversation in the first season with these two very elegant and sophisticated British showrunners who created this, you know, wonderful, touching show that we've heard about a headmaster and his sensitive romance or relationship with a lesbian librarian at the school. And he's like, yeah, we can't do that on American TV. You did that for 10 episodes and it was great. Friends ran for 230 episodes. Imagine if we hadn't had the romance to keep it going. You got to have a romance. Like, you know, he's that guy who knows what we need. Mm-hmm. And he's an idiot and he's a buffoon. And yet he's also the one who understands what television needs from us better than anyone else. I thought that was a very clever spin that I had.
I agree. So what do you want people to ultimately be thinking about sitcoms when they finish reading sitcom?
Well, I think what I found particularly compelling was to think about the history of the sitcom as a whole, to think about the ways in which it's changed and evolved over time. It surprised me in a way that the sitcom itself had been self-referential from the outset. You know, you look at episodes of I Love Lucy and The Honeymooners, especially the ones that I write about in the book, and they're very self-referential. They're about their characters appearing on television. They're about making fun of TV. They're very conscious of TV as a medium in and of itself. And yet, the thing that really happens to the sitcom over time is that it becomes willing to take itself seriously. You know, the sitcom is very self-conscious and aware about its own kind of second-rate status. It's not just not movies, it's also not drama. So it's really this kind of benighted television wasteland. And yet, as television matures, as, you know, people who create television start to take it more seriously, they allow themselves the ability to tell more serious stories or to experiment with how to make people laugh. You know, so something like the Mary Tyler Moore Show allows itself something that the sitcom hadn't really done before, which is to have stories that continue past one episode. Hmm. You know, everything doesn't necessarily go back to status quo at the end of 30 minutes. You know, Lou Grant can get into marital trouble with his wife and get divorced and stay divorced. And, you know, it will progress over the course of multiple episodes or a season. And, you know, I think that ability to sort of tell more long-form stories really evolves both into the kinds of will they or won't they stories that we're maybe all overly familiar with from Cheers and Friends and shows like that, but also I think allows for this kind of maturity in which sitcoms don't feel like they're constantly having to apologize for themselves for existing. Mm-hmm. And say, no, we're part of a tradition, we're part of this artistic medium that is a real thing, that has real, you know, moments of brilliance, and we want to be part of it also. We want to be part of telling stories in a certain way. We're not going to necessarily stick to it constantly. We're not just going to redo what Carl Reiner and Dick Van Dyke did 50 years prior, but, you know, we are part of a tradition as much as novelists are part of a tradition, you know, of Flaubert and Dickens and Proust, or filmmakers are part of a tradition of, you know, Wells and Ozu and Howard Hawks and whoever else. You know, it's taking itself seriously. And I think that that's really one of the more compelling subplots of what happens with the sitcom over time.
Last question. So last time we saw you, you were here talking about your book, Another Fine Mess, about the American film comedy. This time we talked sitcom, about the American TV sitcoms. I'm assuming you're not going to go back in time and write a book about radio sitcoms and radio comedy. So what's next?
I don't know yet. I've got some ideas that I'm thinking about, but I don't have an answer for you just at the moment.
All right. Well, we'll wait. How long do you think it'll take?
I'm always fascinated with any kind of medium or any kind of story that doesn't necessarily get the critical approval that it maybe deserves. So, you know, I'm trying to think about some other ways to tell similar kinds of stories.
Okay. Well, folks, listen, you can find Saul Austerlitz's book, Sitcom, A History in 24 Episodes from I Love Lucy to Community, in great bookstores everywhere, or you can order right now at a great price at MrMedia.com, MRMedia.com. And if you're watching on the website, right down here somewhere, there's the photo of the book. You can click on it. It'll take you to Amazon. You can order it right now. If you're watching us on our YouTube channel, same thing. Right below the video, there's a link to the book. You can click on that. It'll take you there. Saul, do you have a website? Are you on Twitter, Facebook? Can people find you?
Yeah, people can find me on Twitter at Saul Austerlitz, or they can go to my website, which is conveniently named saulausterlitz.com.
Really?
Find out everything there is to find out.
Very good. Well, pleasure to have you back. Sorry for pestering you for so long about the different shows, but it's a great conversation to have. I enjoyed it very much, and thank you, as last time, for joining us on Mr. Media today.
Thanks for having me.